Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Bongiorno. I'm joined today by Miss Nadia Cater.
Hi, Mike. Happy to be here.
Nadia, how are you? How have you been?
Really good, but like super busy.
Well,
I'm hot here.
That's good. You prefer to be busy?
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm busy and like, I'm like really focused on my job. So I love being busy with work that's not bullshit.
Yeah.
And it's like stuff that's really tangible and necessary.
Right.
Because I've had jobs where I'm really busy, but like you're doing nonsense. And it's just like, why am I doing this with my life?
Right. All that bullshit.
That bullshit. Yeah. But now I just like getting off like a really intense couple of weeks. So I'm looking for some downtime. I get like 2 weeks paid off.
Nice.
Yeah. And it doesn't count towards vacation. So.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. I'm a big contradiction. I like to be busy because it allows me to ignore the demons in my mind. I could just fill my life and mind with tasks and not have the voices constantly telling me that things are bad. But then I also am very lazy. I you know, like if I had my way, I would just like sit in a chair. Always. Like just that, I'm fine with that. So today's episode of PCMC is a list-isode. I know you guys love lists. Who doesn't on the internet love a good list? And this one is actually, I don't know. I kept thinking this week preparing for this. Is this topic too esoteric or is it something everyone will kind of immediately click to? But the idea is, these are images from pop culture that we can't get out of our heads. Images you can't get out of your head. So what does that mean? That means it's not your favorite movie or your favorite book or your favorite painting or anything like that. It's something that you saw in pop culture, and that image got branded into your brain, into your subconscious, where it's just something you think of. It's something that's always readily available to you. You could recall it at any point. My list, we both did a list of five, so we'll have 10 together. My list has four that are disgusting and one that is alluring and titillating. What about your list of five? Are they all gross? Are they violent? Any alluring?
I don't know. Maybe there's something going on in my subconscious because everything is dark. Like, I don't have anything sexy or funny. It's just, like, mostly dark. And I would say maybe one is, like, physically disgusting. And, yeah, and one of them is, I don't know if I'd say physically disgusting, but, like, mentally kind of weirded me out, and that's why I put it down.
Sure.
It's just like it's a human act that can really happen, but
right,
you know.
Right. Well, mine are mostly dark too. I mean, I think when we are shown something that is something we don't want to see, or you know, it has a sort of sublime feeling that, you know, I think that's part of what makes it stick. You know, I can't recall every beautiful butterfly I've ever seen, but I can recall these horrifying moments. And mine are all from films.
Yeah, mine too.
Makes sense. Okay, so we'll go back one to the other. We don't know what each other's are for the sake of fun. For the first one, this is a famous one, and this is a good starter point. From the 1980 film, The Empire Strikes Back. The Tauntaun Guts. So if anyone has ever seen this film.
Oh.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, I know that one.
Have you ever seen The Empire Strikes Back? I know Star Wars isn't your thing.
You know, I gotta be honest, I can't remember, but I remember that. So whether or not it happened, that stuck with me.
Early on in the film, our protagonist, Luke Skywalker, is they're on like an ice planet that at night it's uninhabitable. So Luke gets stuck out at night and passes out, and he's on this creature called a Tauntaun, which is pretty cool because they do it with stop motion, and it's like a big Star Wars-y monster horse thing. And Han Solo finds him to rescue him and finds him all passed out, and Han Solo, this is like towards the very beginning of the film, Han Solo takes Luke's lightsaber, and it's also the only time you ever see Han Solo use a lightsaber, so it's cool for that reason. Han Solo uses Luke's lightsaber to cut, because the Tauntaun dies as well. The Tauntaun freezes and dies. So to save Luke, Han Solo takes the lightsaber and cuts the Tauntaun's stomach open. They didn't have to show you, but there's a close-up of the stomach opening. And it's a very, very short scene, but it's one that is stuck in my head and probably a lot of people's heads forever. It's just a short little shot, a little close-up of the lightsaber cutting the stomach and then its innards sort of like coming out. They don't spill all the way out onto the ground, but they just sort of come out. And I've looked at this for so many years. It looks like innards. So there's a lot of tubes going on. It could be like plastic, like blown up plastic, or it could be like they could have went and got like sheep guts or something like that. Because it has something about it. And this is the sort of uncanny thing with a lot of what's on my list is something about it seems totally real to you, even though this is not a real creature that really exists. Something about like, yes, this is what the guts would look like is totally part of what makes it stick in your mind. It's also, I think, a very interesting way to begin the sequel to Star Wars, because Star Wars is like this big, bright, fun, you know, story, and Empire is this much darker tale. So I think it's a very good, I think it's specifically a really good way to begin Empire Strikes Back, to like cut open this monster and show its weird guts coming out. Yeah, so that's number one. And hopefully people totally get what we're talking about now.
You know, I feel like this scene has been reused in media so much, especially parody. Mm-hmm. Like I specifically remember the Family Guy doing the straight Star Wars parody for those episodes.
Yeah.
And they're all just like sitting in the guts and just like waiting for time to pass.
Right.
So I'm like wondering if maybe I didn't see this. I've actually seen just so much parody of it. I could just picture it in my mind.
Yeah.
As like an amalgam.
It's part of the sort of visual vernacular of popular culture. I mean, for anyone who's seen Star Wars, or in your case, maybe not, like if you say, oh, the Tauntaun gut, people immediately go, oh, yeah. Oh, the Tauntaun guts. Yeah. And it's also, I think, interesting that, like, I guess they don't show you what he does, but I guess he puts Luke inside of it to keep him warm. It's very gross. It's a weird way to start your film.
You know, I wonder, like, what was the audience reaction to this? Like, when it, can you imagine, like, in the 80s, people bringing their kids to, like, oh, it's Star Wars. Star Wars
Part 2. It's going to be so much fun.
Yeah. Oh, I looked this up. This is disgusting. You can find it on Google very easily.
Yeah, there's gifts of it.
And also, apparently, they were selling a Tauntaun sleeping bag at one point.
Yes, I did see that. That's fun.
And a toy. There's a toy of someone in Tauntaun. Oh my god.
It's like a costume where, like, for a little kid, where like the kid's legs become the Tauntaun's legs, and then the kid's upper body's dressed like Luke, and then there's like fake legs hanging over. So you look like you're riding the Tauntaun.
That's gross. Oh man. And of course, because I'm on Google Images, someone just made dinner, like Tauntaun guts dinner, and they made like a piece of bread shaped like the Tauntaun. And there's just spaghetti and I guess meatballs just like coming out of the side.
Yeah. Something about the inside coming out for us animals will always have a sort of real visceral reaction. You know, it's like the way some people react to blood. This one's not on my list, but I just thought of it. In I guess it's Aliens. Mm. The second Alien movie, Lance Henriksen plays the cyborg or the android. And like, they have like white milky blood. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was gross.
Yeah, that's a similar vibe.
Wasn't that also in the first movie though too? They didn't know that one of the
Yeah. In the first movie, what's his name? Ian Holmes is is an android, and you don't know that he's an android, and he's like sabotages their mission. And then in the second one, Lance, and it's like, I forget how many years later, it's in the future from the first one. And Sigourney Weaver was like, oh, it's a fucking android. And everyone's like, whoa, not cool, bro. And then he turns out to not be a bad guy. So, you know.
Well, that's disgusting.
Yeah. So what do you got?
So mine is kind of, mine's very different. So this is, my scene is from The Brave Little Toaster.
Okay.
This is a 1987 animated film.
Yeah.
That actually I was looking into this movie before writing it down. And a lot of the producers and some of the animators went on to work for Disney.
Yeah.
So they did all of like that Disney Renaissance stuff like after this movie.
Yeah.
So, which I thought was like, okay. So they kind of, you know, got better, I guess. So the premise of this movie is there's a bunch of appliances living in this long abandoned cabin in the woods. And they just get this idea in their head that they have to go find their master who was a little kid when he left.
Yeah.
Right. We don't really know how long it's been until later on in the movie where you see like a grown up master, whatever this guy's name is.
Right.
I don't even think they tell you really.
It's more like Toy Story now that I think about it.
It's Toy Story before Toy Story because the appliances come to life. They are affected by their humans. And when the humans are around, they stop moving. And they actually, all of them have cartoon faces somewhere,
yeah.
Like eyes and a mouth. And they'll just disappear when they're frozen. So they just look like this furniture. So the Brave Little Toaster is kind of like the leader. And there is a bunch of characters. There's the toaster. There's a desk lamp, AM, FM radio, a vacuum called Kirby, which I assume that's like the company name. Like, I don't think they actually name each other.
Okay.
And a baby blanket that's like an electric blanket.
Yeah.
So they're all deciding that they're going to exit this house that they've been in for years to go find him. I don't know why they didn't think that the parents were the master. They just thought this little kid. Because like they have, the last picture they have of him is like an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, I guess he was using all this shit, playing with the vacuum. So they're going to leave, and there's this air conditioner in the window who's kind of smarmy and, like, nasty, and the voice actor's doing a Jack Nicholson impression.
Of course.
Very weird. And
what year is this again?
This is 1987.
Yeah, I think that tracks.
This was, like, as a... In the 80s, they had a lot of weird, dark children's movies, like The Black Cauldron, and I think The Secret of Nim was.
And I feel like a lot of Jack Nicholson impressions.
Just very, very weird. I think later they also had a lamp or something doing a Betty Davis impression. I'm like, who? What kid knows who these people are? Anyway, So they want to escape, so they're talking about, they're really like psyching themselves up. And the air conditioner is like laughing at them and telling them they're never going to get anywhere. And this kid doesn't care about you. He's not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
He left you, right? So they kind of argue with the air conditioner and they tell him that he's just jealous because he's stuck in the wall and the master could never play with him.
Jeez.
And like, I was like, ooh, this is a little intense, right? So then the air conditioner like stops like kind of laughing and just gets like really angry, like clearly hit a nerve. And he just, like, starts berating them and getting, like, and it just keeps getting more elevated. Like, he's starting to freak out and scream and yell about how it's not his fault that the damn kid was too short to reach his dials. Because apparently, like, the appliances, like, they get a lot out of, I don't think it's sexual, get a lot out of just, like, being used, right? So it's like Toy Story when you're played with.
Right.
You're an appliance.
So if it makes more sense for toys to be with children.
Yeah, I know. So he just like keeps getting heated and he's getting all worked up and then like these sparks are coming out of him and they're like, whoa, calm down. And he just keeps screaming and yelling and then all of a sudden he short circuits himself out and he blows up and he dies.
Okay.
And this is the first 15 minutes of the movie. And why that stuck with me was because I used to watch this movie constantly as a kid. I love this movie. But that part where this guy just keeps screaming and then he just like, I guess the equivalent would be like popping an artery or something, like just have a stroke.
Yeah.
And it just blows up. And it's just such a dark way. And then they just, like, leave the house. And it's like, oh, well.
He's dead.
Well, he's dead now.
So was it, as a little kid, was it like, what do you think you were feeling when you saw it?
See, that's hard.
Scary?
Because I think it was a little scary, but according to my mom, she used to play this for me all the time. So it wasn't scary enough to deter me from watching the movie.
Right.
But it was unsettling enough that I still thought about it like 20 plus years later.
Sure, sure.
It actually bought the DVD because you can buy it cheap on Amazon, right, just to see if it would have that same effect. And rewatching the movie, it's way darker than I remember.
Wow. I haven't seen it since I was a little kid, and I don't recall the scene you're talking about, but now I want to look at it.
It's also on YouTube. I'll send it to you.
Okay.
Because it's so weird. Yeah, and actually, when I was talking to my mom about it, I was like, oh, yeah, I bought this movie. I used to watch as a kid because I was just curious about it. She's like, oh, you love that movie. But I got to be honest, Nadia, I had to put it on and leave the room because it used to creep me out. So she would just, like, leave this movie to babysit me.
Yeah. Well, that's how it was.
Right, back in the days.
Yeah.
But I guess it kind of interested me, too, as, like, a movie that was unsettling for an adult. So that means that she was understanding things that I wasn't, where I was just like, wow, right, adventure.
It is, yeah, it's an odd one. Very, all right, that's really interesting. I have to look that up. Okay, so my next one is from a film that I'm not sure anyone remembers, so I'll have to talk about it. It's okay. 20 years ago, from 2001. It's called In the Bedroom, and it's this sort of very languid, sort of slow-moving drama starring Tom Wilkinson, Sissy Spacek, Nick Stahl, and Marissa Tomei. And it's about Nick Stahl is this young man, and he gets into a relationship with an older woman, Marissa Tomei, and his mother, I think he lives still with his mother and father, who are Tom Wilkinson and Sissy Spacek. And Marissa Tomei's going through a divorce, and her ex-husband is violent and scary. And the mother is kind of like, you know, I don't know if you should date this woman. It seems like trouble. And Marissa Tomei is a very beautiful woman. So the father's like, yeah, way to go, dating her. And that's important because the parents then clash. Because a scene towards the beginning of the film, Marissa Tomei's ex-husband or husband, estranged husband, sort of tries to break into the house, and Nick Stahl, the young boyfriend, kind of tries to stop him, and they struggle a little bit, and then Marissa Tomei runs up the stairs to check on their kids, because they have kids, and she hears a gunshot, and then she goes downstairs. And everything that happens is sort of beautifully composed. We see her coming down the stairs, but in the foreground, we see the husband's hand with a gun in it, like walk off screen, like in media res, like he's just killed the boyfriend and now he's walking away. And we don't see the boyfriend yet, but Marissa Tomei comes down. She sees the boyfriend. She screams. And then the camera just tilts down slightly to show the boyfriend on the ground, and his head, his like half of his face is gone. And this has been a pretty quiet, not violent, sort of very subtle tone of a film. And now there's this guy who we liked, who's a handsome young kid, whose like face is gone. And the camera tilts back. The camera tilts down just to show us the carnage, but also like doesn't linger on it because I think it's just too much. But also because it doesn't linger on it, we only see it for a second. So it's one of these things that in my mind, I thought it was, it's like every couple of years I think about this scene and I go, I got to look it up because I don't know if what's in my head is exactly what I actually saw. Because it happens so quickly, you fill in so much of it in your mind. This time when I was looking it up for this recording, I was like, oh, it's actually not too bad. It's shocking in the context of the film, but compared to like what you see in horror movies, you see way worse. But I remember the feeling of seeing it for the first time, and I saw it in a movie theater, and the whole theater was like a visceral, it wasn't like a scream, but it was like a visceral gut reaction of like, oh my God. this was our handsome lead. We thought this was a movie about him and this woman. And now he has half a face and she's screaming. And then the camera, and this is also an image that's very sticks in your head. The camera, it tilts up to show Mr. Tomei screaming, but then it pans left to like the dining room, and the husband who's just killed his boyfriend is just sitting at the head of the dining room table. Like, I'm the king of the castle. I've retaken my home. Now I'm sitting in my chair. And just his, just all of these images together are really, really chilling. Again, not a lot of people have seen this film. It was critically acclaimed when it came out, but it kind of has been forgotten. I don't remember the whole, honestly, like, that's the thing that I remember most about the film. I don't know if I would even like the film at this point, but just that scene still sticks in my head. And that's, In the Bedroom from 2001. Have you ever heard or seen this film?
No. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's something, you know, it's interesting. Like, you and I both like horror films. Something about visceral, like, bloody horror, not in that genre context, is so impactful. You know, you see a horror movie and you don't turned off by, like, blood and guts and, like, someone's face being taken off. But in, like, a drama where people are, like, just being in love, when somebody's face is shot off, it's very, it's just super jarring.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Do you remember, like, who you went with to see this movie?
My mother and father.
Oh, my God.
So I was 17, because I'm 37 now. Yeah. And I remember they didn't like it, because it was, like, it was a little too slow and arty for them. Like, it's a film where not a lot happens. It's a lot of, there's even not a lot of, like, direct dialogue. It's a lot of, like, what happens in between, you know, scenes in a normal movie. Yeah. So they didn't like it, but I remember liking it. It's an interesting, it also, it reminds me a little bit of the film A Time to Kill. I feel like in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot of, like, movies trying to justify murder. I'm not sure why, maybe the coming Iraq war. I don't know.
You know, I know this is a while ago, but do you remember, like, what prompted you guys to see it? Like, was the advertisements, were they more like, this is a romance or this is a drama?
No,
it was like, if you're expecting a romance and then seeing that would be very, very jarring.
No, we were expecting a drama, and most of the trailers had Sissy Spacek and Tom Wilkinson, who are really the stars of the movie. So we knew that something bad was going to happen. It wasn't such a shock, you know, like, you knew that it was probably about, like, something happened to this guy and his parents dealing with it. But people were like, oh, wow, Sissy Spacek, this is the best performance of her career. It was, like, critically lauded at the time. People were really high on it. And it was a theater full of people.
I always find it so interesting when it's, like, something so big in the time and no one remembers it.
Well, that's, like, the thing. Some things don't have longevity. Something could be really well received and then just kind of, like, forgotten about.
Yeah.
And this film's forgotten about. And honestly, if it weren't for this image of the kid with his face blown off, or the guy with his face blown off, I probably wouldn't remember it either.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I love that idea, though, because I really like when movies just, like, completely surprise you and go a little off genre, you know? Like,
yeah. This,
you don't expect this level of violence from a drama. You don't expect the main character to die. You never expect the main character to die.
Right.
Especially on camera. Like, maybe if you know that's inevitable, the movie will end before that. But this is just, like, he's gone.
Yeah, and yeah.
He dies so needlessly.
Yeah. It's also interesting when you think about, like, the visual economy of a film. Like, if a film has a lot of violence, like a John Wick movie or something, right? You're like, okay, like, one death is meaningless almost. But if it's a film that has, you know, very sort of placid, pretty, you know, images, and then there's just one huge act of violence, there's only one scene that's red, blood splattered. That somehow has this greater weight.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, going back to my last one, I'm now thinking about Empire Strikes Back ends with both the reveal that Darth Vader is Luke's father and Darth Vader cutting Luke's hand off. And I wonder if there's, like, I don't know, there's got to be some dissertation somewhere about that. Like, maybe you could get Freudian and be like, well, the tauntaun is vaginal and the hand is phallic. And it's a, I don't know. I'm just
riffing. Definitely is. Someone wrote this at some point.
Some nerd fucking got a PhD with this.
So Empire Strikes Back, that was the sequel, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Was the last movie in that franchise, in the trilogy, not talking about anything that came after that, was that lighter or was that
way lighter? Because that's where you get the Ewoks that are basically just teddy bears.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, way lighter.
So I wonder why it got so dark. Like light and then dark.
I guess
and then
it's
light.
The middle act. They wanted to really like up the narrative tension.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
All right, so give me another one of yours.
Okay, I'm cheating here. I think you're going to get mad. This is also from the Brave World.
Okay.
Wow,
this movie had a real, real deep effect on your life.
I mean, if it didn't in some way, I wouldn't have cared enough about it to find it again in like my 20s. You know, I wouldn't but whatever. Yeah, but for some reason I was going on like this dark trend. So in the Brave Little Toaster, at some point in the movie, the appliances end up in a junkyard full of like old cars, and they're about to be smashed. Right. So there's this huge. It's basically one of those like compactor machines where they put the car and they smash it into a cube and then just So, which I guess existed at some point. I don't know if those, does that still exist?
I have no idea. Probably.
Yeah. I don't know. So they end up there and they're kind of stuck. And it's, I guess you might call it the climax of the movie, right? Because they're about to be essentially killed. That's what happens when you kill metal. You just smush it. It's not alive anymore, I guess. I don't know how their lives work. That wasn't totally explained. But it's the general gist that when you're squished, you're not a thing anymore.
Sure.
So they end up in the junkyard. It's filled with old cars, like really beat down old cars.
Yeah.
And there's this giant magnet picking up the cars and then bringing them to the compactor and smushing them into little cubes. So it's like they don't even look anything like what they used to as a car. You know, there's no car face, right? It's just like a colored cube with the color reminiscent of what the paint job was.
Right.
So while they're there and they're looking around and looking at these cars, the cars start coming to life and they're like talking about their lives. So the cars are talking about like who they used to be or like what they used to do, what their important function was.
Wow.
And this is a musical film too. So there's a lot of musical parts. So this is one of the musicals. So the musical, so it's picking up the car and a few of the cars actually try to move before the magnet gets them, almost like they're trying to change their mind because they're so broken down, they can't move. So the magnet picks them up and then they're singing about their life. And the chorus of the song, and this is what the song is called, is Worthless.
Oh my God.
It's just like the car singing, I used to do this, this, this. And then the chorus jumps in and all the cars sing together, Worthless, I'm worthless, and it smushes them into cubes.
Wow, that's also reminiscent of the third Toy Story. The way the third Toy Story ends with them almost going into an incinerator.
Oh, right. You're right. You know, I'm wondering if any of those people worked on Toy Story.
I think some of them did. I think.
I know they went into, I know some of them went into like the Disney movies, like Little Mermaid and I think Aladdin.
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff, but I don't know how far that went. It's kind of hard to find Wikipedia entries for like animator from the 80s.
Right.
Yeah. So, actually you can find the lyrics online. I picked it up. I'm not going to sing it. But just like one of the first verses is, I can't take this kind of pressure. I must confess one more dusty road would be just a road too long. And then the chorus jumps in as Worthless, and that's when the car is smashed.
Wow, Worthless.
So, yeah, literally worthless. Like, I as a machine am not worth anything anymore, so I need to get smushed.
It's so existential. What an existential children's film.
Yeah.
It's about impermanence and mortality.
That's what I find, maybe that's why I keep sticking to it, because I really enjoy like thinking about existential things and the human condition, but it's like the human condition with appliances,
right?
And it's stuff that we kind of take for granted, and which happens in the film, all the shit is taken for granted all the time.
Wow.
But you know what if they have feelings?
I've never thought so deeply about the Brave Little Toaster, but now I am, and it's interesting. Wow.
Yeah. And this the whole lyrics are just really, like, really disturbing, because it's just like all these cars who did different things. Like, one is about took a Texan to a wedding. He kept forgetting his loneliness, letting he thoughts turned to home and we turned. And then the next one's singing about I took a man to a graveyard. So it's like, I guess he was a hearse.
So in the scene, can you sort of zero in on a single image? Is it the block that comes out of the crusher?
You know, I think what it really is just the sad eyes of the cars. Like, it's they make the cars look sad because their little headlamps are the lights.
Right, of course.
And they just kind of look sad and they're kind of frowning, and then they're brought over. And also the magnet has eyes and a face too. It doesn't sing or anything.
It's like an executioner. So
it's basically like an executioner, yeah.
Wow.
It's some sick shit.
That is some sick shit.
I'm like, wow, no wonder my mom was like, I'm not gonna be in here.
Yeah, I can't deal with this. No one can deal with that shit. Wow.
I mean, the movie has a happy ending, but then you gotta, like, really think, what's the shelf life of appliances from 1987?
I know, like, really, like, how, it's a happy ending for now.
If also, like, if I think about, can you imagine if this movie was made today? It would be like phones being thrown out every year and a half.
Oh, God, what a sad idea for a remake. Just, like, in a garbage dump, just an island of old phone. And then, like, flip phones are, like, the real untouchables of the culture. Like, ew, you're a flip phone.
Or, like, the brick Nokia. Like,
yeah. Or, like, iPhone 1s that, like, are inscribed for some reason because we did that. And it's, like, got, like, Jessica on the back of it.
And then we learned about Jessica. Like, yeah. What she liked.
Yeah, Jessica was my best friend. She loved me until the iPhone 2 came out. Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. I'm actually sending you pictures.
Oh, wow. Wow. The eyes are so scared, but also sad.
Right? It's like, whoa, you guys really put, like, some thought into this.
Wow. Is that existential. Holy moly.
Man, I wonder if we're ever going to get back to those kind of movies for kids, you know?
I mean, I feel like Pixar does it.
Well, not to
Pixar could get deep.
Yeah, but not to, like, this kind of level.
I think because we're older. Like, I think, I bet you could find a Gen Z kid out there that will tell you that they first thought deeply about death by watching the third Toy Story. Very possible.
Yeah, all right.
I'll go with a pleasant one now.
Me too.
The one pleasant one on my list. Okay. So this is from 1972, from a little film called The Godfather.
Oh.
Simonetta Stefanelli was a young actress, and she played Apollonia, Michael Corleone's first wife, who he marries while in Sicily, and she doesn't live very long, spoiler alert. And on their wedding night, they have sex for the first time, and he, you know, they're kissing and standing up, and she removes her like shirt, whatever, and you see her breasts.
Whoa.
And it's so hard to describe, but I feel like people listening might already know what I'm going to say. Her nipples look shiny. I don't know why. I don't know what the cinematographer Gordon Willis was doing. I don't know if this woman just has shiny nipples. Let me show you.
Oh, yeah. I guess they put some, like, oil on that or something.
Maybe. You think so? They oiled them up so the light would really catch them?
I can't imagine why nipples would be shiny like that, because, like, they're not reflective.
Right. It's almost.
Maybe they put, like, an oil on her chest. And it's just like the nipples is the one that's catching that light.
They look like robot nipples. I mean, she's a beautiful woman and has a beautiful figure. So it's not, I'm not being gross here. It's the odd, maybe odd's not the right word. It's the specificity of the detail here. It's the shininess. I mean, I've had this conversation with other people and be like, yes, the shiny nipples. What you think Francis Ford Coppola was like, yes, her breasts represent the future and the shiny future. And I just don't, it's just, I don't know. All I could say is just Google it. Google Apollonia nude Godfather and take a look at her nipples and tell me you're not allured.
Okay, so when I look up, I actually Googled this. Her nipples actually look weird without the shininess.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they look kind of strange. I don't know. I can't even describe it. I don't know if it's the angle of the shot. They just kind of look like surprised cartoon face. But when you turn and you see kind of the shiny nipple, and that's from the side too. I think it's the lighting. I think the lighting was just catching on a shined up nipple because it also seems like her chest looks really smooth. And as someone who has breasts, breasts don't usually look that smooth. Sometimes there's a hair. Sometimes there's some bumps. Right. Sometimes your skin's a little dry around the nipple. So I think they oiled them up for the scene and they got this light at like a 45 degree angle and it just happens to be clicking on her nipples.
I wonder, she might have been a model or something, because I looked up her name with nude, and I'm seeing her nude in all sorts of other things, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of nudity. Maybe she's done a lot.
Yeah, like, not, there's only that one shot in The Godfather, but I'm seeing her butt in something. I'm seeing her full frontal nude in some other movie. She got naked a lot, I guess, in motion pictures.
Yeah, I kind of feel like, just the general knowledge of the film industry, she probably didn't really have a choice. It's like, look, you're going to be naked or you're not going to be in this movie. This is it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think her body is that incredible, though. But I don't, maybe I'm just, maybe my case.
She is, oh, wow. She was shown topless, although only 16 when the production began.
Oh, God. I'm on.
At 17 when the film came out. She's only 16 in this movie. Well,
she doesn't
look it. Yeah, she's very womanly. Well, I think in the movie, she's not much of a character. She can barely speak English. She barely speaks at all. She has very little agency in the whole marriage. It's very like old-fashioned. Like Michael Corleone basically just asked her father for her hand in marriage. And the father's like, sure, go ahead, take her. And, you know, obviously they're waiting till the wedding night to have sex for the first time. It's all very, nowadays we look at it as all super problematic. I think the film is trying to represent it as somehow charming or innocent in a way.
So yeah. I'm gonna go out and say I've actually never seen any of the Godfather movies.
They're good. But the first one especially.
Yeah, I heard that. Not that I don't want to see them. I'm just never really found a mood, like a time to be like, okay, let's watch The Godfather.
Well, I just gave you two good reasons to watch it now.
Yeah, clearly. I have to watch Nipple 1 and Nipple 2. Movie for this nipple. but what it sounds like is that she's supposed to represent some kind of innocence and
purity. Yeah.
Right before you said nipples, I was looking up Apollonia, and the first Google search that came up was Apollonia's death. So I'm wondering if that's supposed to symbolize like the death of innocence or something.
I think so, because after she dies, Michael Corleone goes back to America and reconnects with his first girlfriend, Diane Keaton, and marries her. Mm. She's in like four scenes, Apollonia. She's more of an image than a character.
Does this actor ever like, I mean, I know there's a lot of nude scenes, but does she like end up having much of a career?
I don't know. I think she has an Instagram.
Maybe she's on, what's that site that celebrities like, we'll make a video for you when you pay money.
Cameo?
Yeah, maybe she's on Cameo.
All right, I found this. This information might not be right at all because I found this on findcelebritywiki.com, whatever that is. Simonetta Stefanelli is an Italian actress, and she was born 30 November 1954 in Rome. Right now, she is 65. She's currently a professional actress in Italy. She is a renowned actress in Italy and other neighboring countries. This website's weird. It gives like her measurements.
Oh no, I don't need that.
Now this could be totally wrong. Simonetta Stefanelli estimated net worth 1.6 million to 10 million. That's quite a margin.
Yeah, that's huge. So
she must have been a model. I'm seeing even more like naked pictures of her.
She
must have started as a model.
It also says that I'm on Wikipedia, you know, the legit internet. Sure. encyclopedia. It says here she quit her acting career in 92 and she owns and operates a fashion store in Rome.
Good for her.
Where she designs purses and shoes. So I guess she like kind of moved on from being nude all the time.
Yeah.
And she was also posed nude in the Italian edition of Playboy in 1973.
1 year after The Godfather. Well, that makes sense. Her nipples were all the rage that summer. So that's my one not violent one.
Well, that's good.
What do you have
not
next?
Not depressing either. That's nice.
Is your next one also from a Brave Little Toaster? What if every single one on your list was from a Brave Little Toaster?
You know, there's actually a possibility. There's a lot in that movie.
Yeah.
But those are the two that like really stuck out with me. If you like watch the whole thing, there's a lot. But no, actually, mine's a little different. We're kind of switching gears a little bit. So my next one is from Faust, 1926, silent German expressionist movie,
yeah,
directed by Murnau. Have you ever seen it?
This is the story of Dr. Faustus?
Well, in the movie, he's not called Faustus, but it's basically based on that story of
he makes a deal with Mephisto for all knowledge.
Yeah.
No, yeah. I have not seen this film. Murnau, that's the same director as Nosferatu, right?
Murnau, yeah. Yeah, he was pretty big. Actually, years ago, I bought this box set of Murnau movies. I've never watched any of them.
Didn't he also do Sunset? A movie called Sunset?
I think he... Sunrise.
Sunrise. Sunrise.
That was also good.
I think I've seen that or some of that.
Yeah, he had a pretty promising career until he died in a car crash in 1931. So he was getting there.
So what's the image from Faust?
So yeah, the storyline is that Faust is an alchemist who wants to learn more about the world and the secrets of the universe, you know, like knowledge. So similar.
Yeah, yeah.
But the movie actually starts out with Mephisto and an angel arguing about his soul. And Mephisto decides and makes this claim to the angel that he can steal Faust's soul because Faust has desire for knowledge, right? And this angel is just kind of like, you know, does nothing. So Mephisto goes to Earth. But what's really weird is that's how the movie's set up. So you're thinking, oh, okay, this guy's going to be like, you know, like tricked or something, or just going to be like greedy. But what Mephisto does is actually release a plague into the village that he lives in and kills half the people there.
Wow.
So it's like, yeah, so if Faust, because he's a learned man, is desperately trying to find a cure. And that's how Mephisto kind of gets him. So I'm like, okay, so this is a little different.
That's entrapment.
That's basically entrapment, yeah. So in his weakest point, Faust like begs he summons the demon Mephisto to make a deal with him. So then he kind of like changes his mind. He gets freaked out when Mephisto manifests.
Mm-hmm.
Because like in the beginning of the movie, Mephisto's this giant thing in like a fursuit with big ass wings. But when he comes down to Earth, he just looks like a little like average sized man with no like demon features. So, but he appears out of nowhere, right? And of course, it's like old trick photography where it's like a doubled image. So that's actually the part I'm getting to. I'm setting this up for a reason. So Faust keeps trying to run away from Mephisto because he's scared. But everywhere he runs, Mephisto just magically like appears.
Oh.
Right? So it's like he can't escape. And then gets up to this one point where he runs to his little alchemist office, and Mephisto appears in a chair. And he holds out pulls a scroll out from nowhere. And it's this big scroll that he's holding out with like both arms like stretched out.
Yeah.
It's like huge and it's empty. And he's holding this thing up. And then all of a sudden you kind of see this like smoke coming from behind the scroll. And you're seeing this on screen and the empty scroll. And then all these letters pop up on the scroll.
Oh, cool.
And yeah. And this is what's different for me. And this is why this image always stuck out to me is I didn't realize they had that technology in the 20s.
It's yeah.
It's like invisible ink or some kind of invisible ink that was the smoke or the heat from whatever fire source they had behind the parchment brought it out.
There's like, no cut hidden in there?
There's no cut. No cut. Wow. It just comes out. And I was like, holy shit. When you know, we were film majors, so we were exposed to a lot of this shit that we, you know, like, general people don't watch movies that are 100 years old anymore.
Right.
And I think it's because, for the most part, we don't watch these kind of movies, but you forget about what they had at the time. And some of these movies are so inventive. And, like, that to me was incredibly inventive.
Right.
And eerie.
Well, yeah,
and
that's what's amazing about, you know, special effects. We kind of demystified them starting from the 80s on with all these behind the scenes featurettes and, you know, shows like that. And, you know, even from like the practical stuff you'd see in like Indiana Jones movies to like the CGI stuff you see now, we kind of all kind of know how it's done. But when you see a visual effect from the 20s, you're like, how the fuck did they do that? And you just imagine that whoever was watching the film at that time, they were really probably blown away.
Absolutely. Like, yeah, kind of like, and when you think of the people at this time, these practical effects, they had to be people that were playing around with this stuff. Maybe, I know at least one early filmmaker was a magician. So he was, you know, used to this like sleight of hand stuff.
Right,
so
Méliès.
So Méliès, who used that in his film.
Yeah.
How inventive they had to be for the time. And I feel like
It's easy now. With CGI has made it easy. Not to say that it's not labor, because it is. And those people really aren't paid enough. But we have tools now that make it much, much easier.
Yeah, I agree. So I'll be honest. I feel like CGI does not have a lasting impression like practical effects.
Yeah.
Not to say that your labor is useless. Absolutely not. Because that, I know that CGI stuff is really tedious and long.
Right.
And laborious. But it just, watching a movie from like 2010 is so, it doesn't look good anymore. I can't think of it. But watching something from like the 20s or the 30s, well, yes, it does still look old, and some stuff are kind of like, you know, it's a little old, but it's still kind of impressive. You know, it leaves a lasting impression in a way that CGI doesn't.
Well, it's really like a magic trick, a lot of those old things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they did this in Faust, but I, like you said, it probably has something to do with the smoke. Or maybe it's a lighting trick. Maybe the ink is there, but you can't see it until the smoke is there or something like that.
I'm thinking it's the heat. So it might have been like lemon juice or something, that when they heated it up, that's when it kind of burns the ink before it burned the paper. That's what I'm thinking. But again, I don't know. I was watching, because I have this DVD, because I have this collection, I watched that scene again last night to prepare myself for this. And there's no indication of who was really the special effects person. Like, those people are forgotten. We don't know who they are.
Right.
And it wasn't as important as like the cast of players.
Right, of course.
Right. And of course the director.
And back then they could have easily hid who did it. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes they would try to like preserve the movie mystery by not even telling you who did certain things.
Yeah, that's true. Like trying to hide their like secret weapon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing is, then you don't really, you kind of lose that kind of appreciation for that person. It's only the film now. And the film would be, and the appreciation will go to like Murnau or Emil Jannings, who played Mephisto. I was fighting between these two. The other one I had in that place for the special effects would have been The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which there's been a lot of adaptations.
Yeah.
But I couldn't remember which version of this. I think it was 1923, but there's a scene where there's like a costume party. So the whole movie's in black and white. And then when they get to the costume party, everything's in color. And it was like the early 20s. So it's like color wasn't, when you watch movies from the 20s, there isn't a lot of color.
Was it painted? Was it like, did it look like it was painted on the actual film? Because I know some people would do that. Or was it like, do you think it was actually color photography?
I actually think it was color photography. I think they had that technology at the time, because I don't have this film to like really dig in, but they had it at the time, but it was so expensive that they didn't use it.
Oh, okay.
But we forget that. We forget that that's the reason why there isn't color, other than assuming that that just wasn't invented.
Right. Well, yeah, and there was versions of color going way back. Yeah, yeah, and I think of Wizard of Oz as playing with black and white and color, but there was a lot of films that did that. There's a Dorian Gray movie, I think, from the 50s or 60s that's black and white except for every time you see the painting.
Oh, that sounds good. Was it good?
Probably not. I don't remember loving it. You know, a lot of adaptation of, a lot of early adaptation of Oscar Wilde will, remove a lot of the queerness.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? So it kind of, the whole thing's kind of like played straight in a way. So, but the only thing I remember is the that playing with color. All right. All right. So my next one, I'm going to say trigger warning, just because we're going to deal with transphobia here for a little bit.
Okay. All right.
So this is from the 1983 horror cult classic Sleepaway Camp. So Sleepaway Camp. So you already know what I'm talking about.
That was going to be one of my picks.
Was it?
I decided against it.
Oh, I'm glad. Okay. I'm glad I didn't step on it. Okay, good. So I'm so we're on the same page. So Sleepaway Camp from 1983 was in that sort of time of slasher movies, Friday the 13th and the Halloween films and Terror Train, and just there was a lot of really low budget independent films that were just people getting murdered, slasher films. But Sleepaway Camp, don't get me wrong, this is a very poorly made film. This is a really cheap movie. This is a movie with very bad acting. And this is a movie that fundamentally is transphobic. But if there's any value to it, which there might not be, if there's any value to it, it's that they do a really interesting job with sort of surreal and uncanny imagery, especially in their flashback scenes. And so it's basically the exact same film as Friday the 13th. Because if you remember the original Friday the 13th, it's a mystery. You don't know who the killer is until the very end. So it's like that. It's a camp, just like Friday the 13th. People are being murdered. You just see hands coming out and killing people in these various ways. And the protagonist is this young, sort of timid girl, Angela. And at the end of the film, it is revealed to us that the killer is Angela, but also that Angela is, I don't want to say trans because it's a different thing. In the world of the film, Angela is biologically male, but is existing as a woman. Now, because of the way trans people were often depicted back then, think about, you know, going back to Psycho, which is Psycho is both the beginning of the slasher film and the beginning of transphobia. Actually, no, it's not the beginning of transphobia, but it's the beginning of creating an image of trans people as murderous, and you can't trust them because they're mad, they'll murder you. We find that Angela's mother wanted a girl so badly that when she was born with male biology, she just decided to raise her as a female. And the film makes it so basically she's traumatized by being forced to live her life as a female when she feels she's a male. I don't know. It's very hard to read this film through our contemporary understanding of gender. But basically, I guess because as a child, she was forced to be female when she was biologically male, and I guess didn't feel inside that she was female the way a trans person would and feel okay with it. Basically, this made her crazy and made her a murderer. So this is why she's killing people. But anyway, the big reveal at the end is an image of Angela completely naked and completely still. And I'm not sure if this was just really brilliant, uncanny cinematography, or if there was a special effects reason why she's so still. But she's frozen almost in time. She's completely still. We see her nude body. We see pubic hair and a penis. And it really doesn't match because the rest of the film, Angela looks like this very live, tiny little girl. And all of a sudden in the scene, she's got almost like a full grown 30-year-old man's body. But then on her head is the actress's head, who played Angela. And she's got her mouth all the way open, but like almost unnaturally open, like totally agape. And she's frozen with her arms out and the bloody knife in her hand, I think. And her mouth is open and her eyes are mad. And she's making a sort of like weird guttural noise coming from her throat. And so she's completely still. It's dark. Her eyes are crazy. We are supposed to be terrified by the fact that we are now this reveal of a male appendage, and that she's the killer, and that she is not the sex we thought she was. And the camera, like, there's interesting camera movement. It sort of pushes in a little bit, but also is tracking from left to right. So it's not just a inward move. It's kind of circling around her in a very slow way. And that's juxtaposed to the two, I guess, camp counselors discovering this and being horrified and, you know, gasping. And the camera's moving similar when we see them. And this is the last moment of the film. And you hear like this very dramatic, scary music. And it's just very, very surreal, uncanny moment that sticks out, I guess, I think to a lot of people who have seen it.
Yeah, definitely. Though I have to point something out because this is my nerd brain going. Actually, Angela was twin. Parents died in a car accident and they were twins, one male, one female. The real Angela died. Mm. But the aunt taking in the original kid, Peter, I believe, says that she didn't want a little boy for some weird reason. So she started calling Peter Angela. So it was like being forced to be Angela.
Right.
Kind of drew that psychotic break.
Right.
But that's so minor. But it's like, it's just so technically you're right in that Angela was raised as a girl, but like after living as a boy for like 8 years.
Right.
So it's very disturbing.
And that made her into a murderer.
Exactly. That's how it works. So I'm looking at, because you can find the scene.
Very easily,
because it's such a forgettable movie except for this twist.
Yeah.
Like, we would not be talking about this if it didn't have this twist. But when you look at the shot, and it is creepy, like the mouth open as if there's a scream, but there's no scream. It's obvious that there is a male actor wearing a mask, because the way the face is kind of protruding, it looks a little bizarre.
Yeah,
and you're right. It also had to be in an adult, though, like maybe a pretty thin kind of adult.
But clearly, like 3 feet taller than Angela has been throughout the rest of the film.
Yes, like way too tall, and just the way the body is standing, it makes no sense. If you like dissect it that way, but it's so strange and so eerie. It is also, if you look, I think, if I'm not mistaken, they covered the neck in blood, so maybe you don't see the line of the mask.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And then the torso is covered in blood. And
that's probably why, because it's a mask, that's why it's a fixed facial expression. Which
is weird, because it's like the choice to make it a scream.
Right.
Without any screaming is such a strange choice, but I guess
scream, it reminds me of Edvard Munch. It's got a Munchness to it.
I'm wondering if that was the idea.
Well, it's one of these examples, kind of like the shark in Jaws, of how like the practical then has to have an influence on the visual. You know, I mean, like, it's probably not in the screenplay that she just stands there motionless with a fixed thing, you know, with a fixed expression, you know, and then that's how it ends. But I guess you're probably right in how they achieved this. And so if that's how they did it, they had to have shot it the way they shot it. But it works in terms of like creating this image that sticks with people.
Yeah, that's the only reason why this movie, like I said, we still talk about this movie. And they did make a bunch of Sleepaway Camp sequels.
Right.
But like in the second or yeah, So, like, in the sequels, it's like Angela has sex reassignment surgery. So, no penis anymore.
Oh, okay.
Still is murdering people for some reason. I don't know. I guess being trans, I guess, because in this film's world, it's like being transgender means you're going to murder people. And you're going to keep targeting adolescents at summer camp.
Sure, why not?
I've seen none
of the sequels.
Me neither. I only watched Sleepaway Camp, and I only watched it because I knew that was the scene, because I heard about it. So I was like, let me just see how this is, knowing what was coming. But I can't even imagine people paying for this schlocky movie and not expecting that at all.
Right, right.
You know, like that was probably like really wild at the time.
Yeah. Yikes. Anyway, so... It's completely politically offensive, but it's an image that sticks out in people's minds. So what's next for you?
Yeah. So we're jumping up about 50 years. And my next scene is from The Brood.
Okay.
You've seen it, right?
Of course.
Yeah. So, but this is what's weird. Like, I watched The Brood kind of recently, maybe in the last 2 or 3 years. Because I've just been in like a body horror kind of mood at the time.
Sure.
And what's the premise of the movie, just for the audience sake, is that this couple is going through this like intense custody battle and they're barely talking.
Right.
While this is happening, like the custody of their shared daughter, who I believe is named Cassidy, and it's really nasty. The wife is that soon to be ex-wife is living at some kind of psycho commune where people use this kind of, I don't even know how to describe it, but, and I like some form of meditation to get their like bad feelings or like traumas out of their body. Meanwhile, while this is happening and they're having this nasty custody battle, there are these murderous dwarf children who don't look like human beings. They kind of have like beaks and white hair, and they're like murdering people like viciously. So that's what's happening. And spoiler alert for a movie that's older than all of us, it turns out that the wife is manifesting her rage and creating these creatures as they're coming out of her skin, and then she's sending them off to kill people, like the targets of her rage. So she's like furious at this woman that she thinks is dating her ex-husband.
Yeah.
The dwarfs go out and murder this woman, right? Like, that's the connection between all the murder victims. It's like people that she's pissed off at. So, so the brood scene itself, like the birth scene, is particularly disgusting, but that's actually not what I'm talking about here. What I want to talk about is when the parents finally have that confrontation, because they're not really shown in the movie the entire time. It's like they're having these arguments and these frustrations like over the phone or like talking to other people, but they're not talking to each other, which I feel like is very, very reminiscent of whoever, anyone has divorced parents like I do. That's exactly what it's like. They're not talking to each other. But then it gets to this part where the final confrontation, and the main character, who is the husband, Barton, is trying to get her to stop making these things because they're killing people.
Right.
And her rage that she can't outright have custody of her daughter, she decides that she'd rather her daughter be dead than have to lose her. So so the things actually kidnap the daughter and are about to be like, they're going to murder her. So he's trying to stop his wife from killing, just stop doing what she's doing. But she doesn't care. She's giving birth to these things. And that's when he realizes there's nothing he can do. And so the scene that really shot out me is when he, in a rage, he strangles his ex-wife to death. And that kills the brood and stops them from forming.
Yeah.
And why that was so visceral for me is because in this movie where, like, you know, these weird freak monsters that are just, like, bludgeoning people, right? You know, it's like science fiction. But it's also a lot of the rage and the anger has to do with being in a failing marriage, like an ending marriage. And the fact that he had to strangle her to stop it is was really disturbing, because in movies, when we see someone getting strangled, it takes like 2 seconds, you know? It's like they're gone. Hands on the neck, then they're squeezed, dead. But in reality, it takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is not a good way to kill somebody. It takes a long time, and it's brutal. And in that scene, it felt incredibly brutal. And maybe not as long as it would take in reality to strangle somebody, but just seeing someone, like, who used to love this woman and has shared a child with her, and just strangle her because he can't get through to her is so scary to me.
Yeah.
And then you have to think of, like, the what comes out after that, right? Because, so, that means this girl lost her mom. She was already through this trauma of being kidnapped by these monster dwarf things. And she lost her mom. Her dad killed her mom.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows what's going to happen to her? Like, what if someone finds the dead mom in this, like, in this weird meditation thing? Like, he'll probably be the first suspect.
Right.
It's just so, because it's a horror movie, you know, nothing's ever wrapped up in a neat bow. It's all just like, it kind of just ends the story.
Right.
And looking into this movie, Cronenberg, and I'm sure you know this, is Cronenberg was directing this movie, writing this movie, when he was going through his own really nasty divorce and custody battle.
Right.
And he's been quoted in interviews as saying, watching that final scene where Barton strangles his ex-wife was very satisfying. You know, it was like this movie was his
So he just made a movie about how he wants to murder his ex-wife.
Yeah, basically. It's like, it's really nasty.
And kill his children. Have them disappear.
Ugh, yeah, it's gross. Yeah. It's like really, really gross and really unsettling. And that's always stuck with me. It's just like someone can... Because you have this relationship, this nasty relationship is built over the course of the movie. So it's not just something that's shown. It's like you feel his rage and you see her rage manifest, and it's happening for like the entirety of the movie. And then the climax is her being strangled to death.
Yeah.
It's really sick.
There's no shortage of gross, visceral images in the films of David Cronenberg, from The Fly to Shivers to, you know, David Cronenberg is known for things like this. When I got my master's, I wrote my thesis on the films of David Cronenberg. So I've seen a lot and read a lot about David Cronenberg. And yeah, his whole thing is body horror and the inside coming out. And, you know, he had this thing, especially early on, of like emotions manifesting themselves physically. And that's sort of what you see. And even just like, I remember when I think of that film, I remember the scene where you first are revealed the brood, and you see, like, I guess it's the mother, and she's got like all these umbilical cords coming out of her, connected to all these little, connected to all these little brood monster children. And, you know, that's the sort of gross image that sticks in my mind from that film.
Yeah. I was thinking about, like, because I knew that if we used one of these like Cronenberg movies, there's so much to take from. So I wanted to, and also like the gross, when the dwarfs come out of her and they're all like red and shit, it's like really nasty. Or when she picks up her dress and you just see like these protruding bulbous things. Like, there is a lot of that just really visceral stuff. But I think what I was connecting was the emotional with the physical. And that's what really stuck with me.
All right, so I'll go to my last one. My last one is from the 2013 film Snowpiercer. I talked about Snowpiercer a couple episodes ago when me and Janine did an episode on best fights in movies, and I talked about the tunnel fight. But it comes up here again because Snowpiercer, which is a film about a post-apocalyptic future where all that's left of humanity are living on a train that's constantly going around the entire Earth. It revolves around the Earth once a year, so it, you know, takes a whole year. And it's sort of a perfect metaphor for capitalism. At the very front of the train, there's luxury and fine food and all sorts of beautiful things. And then at the very back of the train is complete poverty and squalor. And it's about a revolution that started in the back that makes its way towards the front. Well, anyway, in the back, these people that are living in squalor, they eat these protein bars. That's all they have to eat. These, like, they're kind of brown. It looks like algae. It looks like it just looks like it's sort of like shakes like Jello. It's these brown bars, and that's what they eat to keep themselves alive. That's all the food they have. These brown protein bars. It's all they have. And as the film goes on, and they make their way through from the back to the front of the train, you know, they see all the, you know, they see the school car, they see the club car, they see, and, you know, they see how the whole world works, and they get to a point where they see the maker of the protein bars, and he's this weird guy, and he's showing them the machine of how they make the protein bars. And the main character is Chris Evans, Captain America. And one of the characters, there's this big machine where the protein bars are made, and you just see like a conveyor belt coming out of the machine with like these flat bars, and then you know, knives coming down and like cutting them into the little bars. And one of the characters sort of climbs up a ladder and looks into the top of the machine and is like, oh my God. And Chris Evans is like, what? And then Chris Evans climbs up and he looks also through this hole at the top. And this is actually a CG shot, but it's very visceral. It works very well for CG. You see inside millions of cockroaches and insects, and you see these circular, like almost like screw type grinders making its way through and grinding up all of these disgusting insects. And there's so many of them, and they're crawling and they're trying to get away from the grinder, but the grinder's just, it looks like water. It's like a sea of insects. And you realize this is what they have been eating. They have been eating these protein bars made out of just ground up roaches. And it's a moment of horror, and it's a moment of repulsion. And I remember I actually watched this on Christmas morning a few years ago, the first time I ever watched it. And I put this number one on my list because it's one that still sticks with me and turns my stomach, just the shock of it. And I know there are cultures out there that eat insects, and it's very normalized for them. And I know that, you know, we may in the future have to eat insects or really turn to plant protein. But just the way that it is figured in the film, and the way that you see them just ground up, just this horrible genocide of roaches to make these disgusting bars, it sticks with me. And you can look this up, look it up on YouTube. You can also find a GIF of it. And yes, I say GIF, not JIF. I know the creator said JIF, but he's wrong. It's GIF. So you can find a GIF of it. It's pretty gross. Have you ever seen Snowpiercer?
I haven't, but it's been like on the back of my mind to see at some point. I just feel like it seems so, you know, sometimes I feel like films are too close to what might happen in like 20, 30 years. It kind of bumps.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You might. I agree.
So it's kind of like, ooh. But, you know, they are trying to make insect protein trendy. Like, you can buy cricket flour, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I knew someone who ate cricket tacos in a restaurant.
I mean, it makes sense, actually, because insects procreate and multiply so readily. I mean, if you don't mind the fact that you're killing them, insects are almost like the renewable energy we've been searching for.
Yeah.
I mean, all you need to breed them is very, very simple. I'd rather eat plant protein myself, but I'm a vegetarian in general. So I don't like any living thing ingesting it. But it's pretty, yeah, it may become trendy. It may be a time that we look back on this film as quaint. Because like right now you're seeing the big popularity of like plant protein that is made to feel like meat, like Impossible Burgers or Beyond Burgers. And I think probably the next thing we're going to see is like a chicken version of that. And in 10 years, you know, what if you have something that looks and tastes like a burger, but, you know, is bugs? They probably won't call it that. They'll say like a pest protein or something like that. They'll come up with some really marketable way of saying it, but
but I mean, I think though, out of all the kind of insect proteins that are possible, I think that roaches are possible, but I don't think they can sell them. It's just they're too much like a pest, whereas crickets, or at least where we are in America, crickets are not seen as vile invader species.
Right. Roaches are really, in terms of PR, roaches really are the bottom of the, their Q rating is very low. Like, a roach is considered like the absolute, like, you don't, like, to see a roach in your house is like, oh God, a roach. You know what I mean? Roaches are like the bottom of the barrel in terms of like bugs. You know, if ladybugs are bugs that are actually kind of cute, roaches are the exact other end of that spectrum of like, oh, oh yeah. Roach.
Ugh. Never.
So that's my last one.
Okay, that's a good one. That's very visceral. And it does like hit into that uncanny. This can be a possibility.
Yeah, you bet.
And that's unsettling. So my last one is gross, also gross, but in a more body horror way. It's from a pretty much forgotten movie from. It was originally released in 1989 in Europe, but America was a little slow on the take, and it wasn't really released until 1992 in America. So it's called Society.
Society.
So it's a very forgettable name, too. It was directed by Brian Yuzna, who went on to direct a lot of kind of schlocky horror movies, like Bride of Reanimator, Return of the Living Dead 3, and he also did the two dentist movies.
Okay.
The Murderous Dentist.
Sure.
I don't really remember that much about outside of it's a dentist that kills people. That's all I remember. So kind of forgettable, honestly.
Yeah.
Not really an auteur here, but Society was very different in that the special effects were really shocking. So the premise of the movie is that this teen who was adopted into a wealthy family kind of feels like an outcast.
Yeah.
Even though he lives in this wealthy house with these people, he still feels like he doesn't belong. And, you know, not to make this long, it turns out that all the wealthy people in town and all the people with power.
Yeah.
Are actually of another species. They're not like human, including his parents and his sister.
Okay.
And what they do is they're a kind of species that regularly just like do complete, I don't know what to say, is they have orgies. They have these like really large, intense orgies with each other. But what happens during these orgies, they all meld together and become one big kind of blobby, melty thing.
I've never heard of this film.
I feel like you would really appreciate the special effects because the plot isn't great. And then there's like a love interest shoehorned in and, you know, you don't care. And it would be a more forgettable movie if not for the special effects. So it turns out like how they feed is that they take the nutrients from human beings. So they kidnap.
I'm looking up images from it.
Isn't it great?
I'm seeing images from the orgy.
Oh, it's disgusting.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, so they kidnapped this dude, like, who dated the sister and then left her because he found out she was one of these creatures. They kidnap him, and they bring him into this orgy, and he melts away, and he's just, like, because he's human, so he can't, like, go back to his form. So they basically just, like, absorb him. And the scene that if you look on the Google images, you kind of see like some of the more famous stuff. We get the orgy, and then we have like the father's face and a butt.
That's the poster.
That's the poster. So that butt scene was also really bizarre. That's when he finds out his parents are also like in on it. So, like,
oh my
when they're having
God! It looks like it's kind of funny too.
It has a lot of humor to it, but it's still very, you know, gross, just very gross. So I'm talking about the climax of this movie. More like the end. So the main character is kidnapped and is being absorbed into the orgy.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he's going to be, because he's human, he's going to be absorbed and he can't come back. So they're all like, you know, feeding off him and fucking, but then he like reaches his arm into the moving pieces, and he actually ends up pushing his arm all the way up through like the, what's it called? I wrote head dude here because I didn't have access. I didn't have time to watch this movie again, but like, he, the head guy, and he literally puts his hand all the way up this guy's body, and his fingers kind of stick out of the guy's eyes and mouth, and he pulls him inside out. And that's how he ends the orgy and saves his own life. By pulling someone inside out from the inside.
Whoa.
It's shocking. Like, it's,
I need to see this movie badly.
I've told you. Like, you gotta watch this. Oh, just for the effects alone. Like, don't go in expecting some Citizen Kane shit. Like, it's not, the acting's not great.
Sure.
And there's some plot holes. But overall, like, that was just so...
plot holes. There's plenty of holes in this movie.
Yeah, there's plenty of holes in this movie. And the incest orgy is a little much. Because his sister is having sex with her parents. Like, regularly. Yeah. But, yeah, that... really stuck with me, because as there's so much of this movie that like begs to be forgettable, and then like that scene is so unbelievable.
Wow.
And it's really good, but it's weird, but it's because everything kind of when they're all like melding and stuff, it gets very like, they kind of look like, to me, melting plastic.
Yeah, I was just looking at a GIF of the orgy scene, and you can make out some things that you can understand, like a leg or an arm. But then there's also just weird, fleshy-looking things, and everything's kind of connected. It looks like a giant flesh machine that's sort of undulating and pulsing in these different places. It's you're kind of like, what am I looking at?
Yeah, it's so freaky. And, like, during their melding scene, there's other scenes in the movie, like, before that climax kind of thing, and it's and some of them kind of get stuck together in weird places. Like, they'll be like two-headed people, or someone will have like a hand for a head.
Yeah.
Like, stuff like that. It's so bizarre. So I'm looking up where you can find this movie, and you can find it on Tubi, which I don't know if you've ever used Tubi, but it's a free streaming service with ads where you can watch a lot of schlocky horror movies.
I've never used Tubi.
It's great for finding stuff that it's kind of hard to, like, horror movies that will be hard to find.
Okay. Ugh. So, but I'm gonna find it.
Yeah, I think it also says it's on Amazon too. I think you can rent it.
Sure.
From Amazon. But yeah, overall, it's such an experience. Like, I've watched a lot of body horror stuff, and like, this is something that's always stayed with me because it's so bizarre.
Wow, damn, this has been a gruesome episode of PCMC.
Yes.
With the small little reprieve of Apollonia's breasts.
Tiny nipples.
Shiny nipples. gosh, well, a lot of food for thought. We got a lot of recommendations for people out there. If you're listening and you have something has come to your mind that you want to share with us, please slide into our DMs over at PCMCpod on Instagram. And while you're there, follow us. We're also at PCMCpod on Twitter and TikTok. If you like what you heard, PCMC comes out every Wednesday. We have an episode called the Starter Pack episode, which is a really great starting point if you're new to the show and want to know what it's all about. I might also suggest that you go up on the episode feed and look at the topics and see if there's something that tickles your fancy. There's something for everybody here at PCMC. Nadia, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me, Mike. This was fun.
You know, from Society to The Godfather to The Brave Little Toaster, we've unpacked it all. We end every episode by saying go bye-bye.
Go bye-bye.